This week on Writers, Inc.
And I think that energy, for especially for a first novel, was great because you don't get to be like a princess about it. You don't get to indulge in the like, and I wanted this done. And more than anything, I felt like, yeah, that first novel feeling of like, oh, I want this out in the world. I want this to be done.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So none of you, all your kids are kind of like growing up, right? No, none of you have young kids.
Correct. Like
Kevin's got a dog. Kevin's got no kids.
I have a dog. So my
daughter is wrapping up third grade. They've got, I think, about a week and a half left. So they've got all kinds of activities that they always lump at the end of elementary school for like the last like week or two. Like yesterday was field day. They were outside playing with the fire trucks, you know, from the town, all kinds of crazy stuff outside. This Friday is a talent show. And my daughter signed up, and I taught her how to play Bad from Michael Jackson, like on the keyboard.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, and she nails it. Like, she's got it perfect. But the problem is none of the kids in her school know who Michael Jackson is or that song. They do know Weird Al, and they know the song Fat.
Your daughter's going to get canceled at school.
Yeah, so here's the dilemma. So, like, in their mind, like, all the kids know that song. Oh, so, like, man. I sat down and explained to her, no, this was actually Michael Jackson. Here's a video of him in the song. And she's like, no, it's Weird Al, Fat. It's this, that. And, like, and I thought that, you know, after, like, a half hour, we had it all squared away. And I just saw the schedule, and it says Ember Barker, Fat, written on the calendar, so.
You'll just have to play the Michael Jackson video in the background so we can see that.
I tried to do that too. Like I found a really cool, like she only plays for like a minute, you know, because you can only do an intro on a keyboard for so long. Yeah. But I found a cool like Michael Jackson like montage of him just dancing. And I was like, you need to just put this on the screen behind. And she's like, no, because all my friends think when boys dance, it's goofy and silly.
She has never seen Tom Holland in Umbrella. I will tell you that.
That is true. That is. Did you see that they released, like, scientists figured out the most ideal dance moves?
And it's like the worst dance moves you've ever seen.
It was
really
the worst. Yeah. I had questions for the scientists and who they showed it to. Yeah. I'm really questioning a lot.
It was like, how men should dance to attract women. And I looked and I was like, if a man danced like that anywhere near me, I would think there's something very wrong with him. And back away slowly.
Yeah. Challenge accepted.
Yeah, you know what's scary is like that's going to end up getting out in the wild and it's going to get clipped up on TikTok and guys are going to be dancing exactly like that video.
Yeah.
Yep. And
for laughs, though, I think.
Well, hopefully they learned some valuable life lessons. It's not good.
The important part is, did you get to spray your daughter with a fire hose this week? Because I thought that was a thing that was happening, or was that a joke?
No, that was for real. They do this every year. So, you know, we live on a little island. We've got our own police department. We've got our own fire department. There's like four people that work in both of them, you know, so it's all real close knit. So every year they bring the fire trucks over at the end of field day and the parents get to get up there and take the hose and spray the kids, which is always fun. But it didn't happen yesterday because the fire guys, they were in a training session like in another town yesterday, so like they weren't able to come.
Doesn't that hurt? I mean, isn't that
no the, you can you can dial it back,
dial it down a little bit.
Yeah, you guys sent that Adam Sandler video where it shoots the kid like 50 feet across the room, but no, you can rein it in.
UHF, man. Yeah,
that's UHF, that's Weird Al.
That's right. Weird Al.
I feel better.
I forgot all about that movie.
Yes, UHF.
You get to drink from the fire hose.
You got it in stereo right there. All right.
All right. Kevin, what is in the news?
Oh, that's a good question. You'd think I'd have things queued up by now. In the news, Netflix launches hub for book-inspired storytelling. Netflix has launched a new feature called Watch Your Favorite Books, a dedicated hub that helps viewers discover movies and TV shows based on books all in one place. The hub is organized by reader personality types, such as plot twist lovers, romance readers, and nonfiction fans, so users can find adaptations that match the kind of books they already enjoy. Rather than promoting individual adaptations, Netflix is building an entire recommendation ecosystem around readers, making books another pathway into its streaming catalog.
This is Bravo.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very excited about this.
I love this as an idea, but I'm going to ask you guys a question. When you go on Netflix, do you actually, like, have you ever gone to the categories and browsed like that? Like, I've never drilled down that far into the menu. And
you know what? Sometimes I do when it's like, if you like this, you like this. Or if I'm like in the mood for a comedy or something, I will. But like as a reader, if it was like things based on books, oh yeah, you know, I would be in there scrolling that category.
Sure. Yeah, their promotion needs to be something along the lines of sending out emails and things that say, hey, what's your favorite book? And, you know, and maybe give a selection of books that the people readers can, would you like to watch this book and then see what happens?
Because
otherwise, I don't know it's there. You know?
No, I hope it gets traction because I do think that if it picks up, then, you know, more book adaptations instead of just kind of the same ones. Maybe it'll encourage Hollywood to get a little creative instead of, you know, making 18 Pride and Prejudices. We could, you know.
Speaking as someone who currently has a couple of books, or actually several books that are in consideration for streaming on Netflix, I approve of that plan.
Yeah. Because there's so many that, you know, books they get picked up and then like they never get made. And then they're like, we're going to make a new Ghostbusters. And it's like, I mean.
Yeah. Here's Devil Wears Prada 90.
Right. Yeah. At least The Devil Wears Prada 2 was an actual book. I don't know if they followed it in the movie, but it actually was a book.
Oh, there was a book. Oh.
Yeah. I think. Yeah, there's like four in that series, maybe, if I remember.
Is this like a Michael Crichton Lost World scenario where it's just it's got the same title, but it has nothing to do with the book?
I don't know. I only read the first two, but I think I have the other three. They don't even call the third and the fourth one The Devil Wears Prada. It just follows the main character through her life. I think one is like, has Lululemon in the title, I think. I don't remember.
I have never even seen the movie.
Well, it was fun.
I saw the movie.
Yeah.
I'll have to check Netflix. Maybe it's on there.
It probably is. I think it is. I think I just saw it the other day. This next one I just put up because I wanted to hear Kevin read it. So,
audio erotica plus sexy celebrity narrators equals profit. The woman-focused audio erotica platform Quinn has been capitalizing on thirsty fans by hiring celebrities to voice their content. For example, you can listen to heated rivalries, Connor Story and Hudson Williams, and a steamy enemies to lovers romantic story about rival Faye princes, or the Pitts, Sean, I don't know how to pronounce this name, Sean Hattasey.
Sure.
The Pitts, Sean Hattasey as a Michelin star chef in a forbidden romance, or off campuses, Mike Abdallah and Stephen Kaelin in a roommates to lovers romantic drama.
That's fun.
Audio erotica.
Audio erotica. Well, why not?
Why not?
I know there's a couple of male narrators that make a fortune just because they work in this particular space. Like they've got huge followings. They go to conventions. Like people will, you know, they come to see them, line up for them just because of, you know, they know them from these books. So
yes, Jenna will send me all of their talks on Instagram and I get them in my DMs and it's fantastic.
My algorithm is very interesting. What can I say? I've worked really hard on it.
I'm not complaining. There were no complaints in that sentence right there.
Yeah. I think they're funny. The ones where they're like, choose the romanticy narrator as your GPS and, you know, instructions. And then they're like, I'd crash my car.
Exactly. I don't know. I would sign up for that. I'm trying to think like who I would want to read books. I guess it's very voice driven and not as visually driven. So I'd have to give that some thought.
That's what I was just thinking. I mean, it's tough to just pick somebody out of a TV show because like, you don't, you know, you see them all the time. You don't really think about the voice that you're hearing. It would almost make more sense to like go after like radio DJs or like somebody that you never actually see. Because some of the greatest voices in the world, like when you see the person in real life, they look nothing like what you would expect.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I do wonder if, because I know that for a lot of these shows, you know, people will watch it the first time, but then it becomes like a comfort show. And so they just put it on in the background. And so they do get a little bit more attuned, I think, to the voices than the faces in that aspect. So I wonder if that's kind of also playing a role in like how this is working out. It's interesting. Good for them. I'm glad they're making their money.
Me too.
Satisfying people's needs.
It's just about every day now that I think I chose the wrong career path. All right, final story. Hot girls don't weaponize trademarks against small businesses. The book community might have a greed problem. A book creator sparked controversy after trademarking the phrase "hot girls read" and telling other small businesses to remove merchandise using that phrase. Critics argue it's a community-created slogan that existed long before any one person claimed ownership. The debate has become bigger than one trademark. Many readers and writers see it as part of a growing trend where people try to monetize and control community culture, turning shared jokes, phrases, and traditions into private business assets. The article argues that online book communities have shifted from a culture of mutual support and sharing toward one focused on branding, monetization, and ownership. The trademark dispute is being held up as an example of what happens when community identity starts being treated as intellectual property.
This whole thing is crazy. She didn't even start using the phrase till 2023 and claims that she never saw anyone else using that phrase. Meanwhile, it's in merchandise in Barnes & Noble, Amazon, like Home Goods. Like it's been around since like the early 2000s. I have no idea how she got the trademark, but I do not think she's going to keep it.
Then clearly, someone at the trademark offices is not doing their job and not paying attention, because this stuff happens all the time.
Yeah.
We've had authors who've trademarked things like, what was the billionaire
Cocky.
One? Yeah, Cocky. Somebody trademarked was trying to trademark having a silhouette of a figure holding a gun on a thriller novel. It's ridiculous, and it irks me to no end, because all it does is make life harder for everybody.
Yeah,
and ultimately you're going to lose on grounds of this is just not a trademarkable phrase.
Yeah,
you're just never going to be able to defend it, and so you're going to lose a bunch of money in the end.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, we all have to deal with your lawsuits and all the BS around
that.
Well,
yeah, but you can send these cease and desist and takedowns, and you don't have to do anything about it, right? So when you're trademarking something, the only way you can, well, I guess you can do a lawsuit for anything, but the only way you're going to win is if there's brand confusion. So I don't know how you would show that in this instance.
Well, as somebody who's trademarked a couple of different things, the way that it actually works, that the trademark office doesn't really do a search. Like they do a rudimentary search, but they don't dig deep.
Yeah.
You actually attest that nobody else is using it. So they ask you when you're filing the trademark, are you aware of anybody else using this? And I guess they use that as their fallback. And then the trademark itself is put out in a public place, and there's a certain amount of time where somebody can come in and object.
Yeah.
And if nobody objects, then you get the trademark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so,
what's happening.
So that's how she got it. Like, she did this quietly. Nobody, I think, actually looks at that stuff. You know, back in the day, it was printed as a notice in the newspaper. You know, it could be any newspaper, you know. So, you know, it's just it could slip through.
Don't think she'll keep it, but.
No, there's massive objections going on right now. There's like petitions and everything going to the copyright
boggles
office.
My mind when people do this, because, you know, the one that in that article referenced was the Cocky Gate, you know, the romance author that tried to trademark the word cocky, and, you know, and I don't even think she has a career now. So, like, that's what's going to happen.
She has a career running from the police.
Yeah.
Like,
go look into her story. She's fun.
Yeah.
Go look her
really
up.
Really interesting. Oh.
Yeah.
My favorite comment in all of these threads was, should I trademark arugula?
Well, it was kind of fun, and not that I, you know, condone this kind of behavior, but people went back through her old account and were like, I'm sorry, I've trademarked the exclamation mark. I need you to take this down with love. I don't know. I think she kind of brought it on herself.
By the way, there's no regulation or law over sending cease and desist letters. You can write a cease and desist letter for any reason.
For anything, to anyone.
Yeah.
And if they get intimidated, you win, right? So
yeah,
notice.
You don't even have to own anything. You just send a Cease and desist, the use of the phrase desist. Barnes and Noble. You might win.
Yeah, but I think, like, in general, the point of this is that the book community is sick of people trying to monetize book recommendations, things they come up with, things that they love. They don't want this as a cash grab. They want it as a shared community experience and fandom, right? So,
particularly, you know, someone who admits openly on social media that she didn't even really read until 2023. So it's like you have someone who, like, just sort of like rediscovered books, which is great. But then she, like, jumped into a community, started profiting from it, and then was like, I'm going to take this. By the way, Book Boyfriend is pending in the trademark office. If anyone wants to go,
we better
protest that.
My book boyfriend is very upset about that. So
it's ridiculous that these people think they can, like, now no one can use that. Like, just
she didn't read till 2022. And it, like, her first book was How to Lose Friends and Piss Off People.
Right. I know. Like, you know, it's fine. And then if you also further irony, like, her very first piece of merchandise that ever sold, that, like, sold well, was a Cher quote, like, literally from Cher, that she didn't attribute to Cher. She just used the quote. And
That's
then fantastic. She did this whole thing with the what is it? Pantone, I think, are the, you know, those paints.
Yeah.
A whole set of bookmarks using that, like, blatantly stealing, like, their font and their, you know, like, it's just.
If you take a step back, I think what's really happening here is, like, that space has gotten very, very crowded. You know, like, it's almost like the author community, like, everybody decided, I'm going to write a book now and put it up on Amazon and make $1 million. Like, all these people just kind of jumped on that train. The review community is just as crazy because anybody can do it. You just pick up your phone, you record a video, take a picture, throw some text on it. And, you know, as soon as people start doing it, then they start thinking, like, well, how can I differentiate myself from all these other people that are doing it? And then they start doing crazy things like this.
Yeah.
Love
it. All right. With that.
It's definitely the way to go. Definitely you should do this.
It could all be solved with a steel cage match. That's how we fix it.
I really do think a good friend and I used to have a concept we called celebrity bat, which we thought would solve all crime, which was after you commit a crime, you get locked in a cage with a celebrity with a bat.
Okay.
Whoever comes out is the victor. You can be absolved of all crime. If you, whatever your crime, if you can survive the bat, they get to hit you anywhere they want.
My celebrity.
That is a very Kevin idea. I'm not opposed. I think we should take it one step further, put it on pay-per-view, and eliminate income tax.
Okay, I'm starting the GoFundMe for this. Or Kickstarter or something. Look for Celebrity Bat. Send your emails to me.
JD, who is up this week? Stop the madness.
This week we've got Carolyn Kepnes coming back on. Carolyn's the New York Times bestselling author of the highly popular You series of books, as well as the Netflix series, both featuring Joe Goldberg. She's back with a prequel called You First, which releases on June 9th. Here she is to tell us all about it, Carolyn Kepnes.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Jana.
Yeah, I will admit, I'm a huge fan. I've been following your writing journey since the very first Joe, where I have tried to get people to read my favorite psychopath ever since.
And I appreciate that. There is nothing like that word of mouth from the sick little heart.
Yeah, Joe is fantastic. Really loved how you sort of pivoted to a prequel in a way. But we'll get into that. Before we start with Joe, or I guess because we're starting with Joe, let's go all the way back to the beginning. What is your writer origin story? How did you get started writing?
When I was little, I remember wanting to read so badly and feeling left out and, like, jealous of all the adults in the world and my older brother. So as soon as I could write, I was in diary mode. Like, I was in every day. Today, this happened, that happened. And I feel like it grew from there, and playing with my dollhouse and getting to the point where the dollhouse was, there was someone, you know, there was always someone locked in the attic. There's a lot going on. And
Rochester.
You just want to write things down. Yeah. You want to have things in writing. And my mom always used to say, don't put it in writing. And I feel like that's the writing prompt, the original writing prompt.
Mom saying,
well, why not?
Don't write that down. I'm going to write that down. So, what was that transition then from, sort of like writing as a kid and diarizing everything to then creating stories and then moving into the publishing world?
Yeah, it started. I'm very lucky. I had the most wonderful high school English teachers, and I wrote a short story and sent it to Sassy Magazine. But the writing experience of it, do you remember the song She Talks to Angels by the Black Crowes?
Yes.
Yes. I love that song. And I was like 13. And so I wrote this short story about angel dust and wanting to take my feelings about that song and kind of put them there. And I'd written in like fourth grade, the novel, that kind of thing that was like a go nowhere type thing. That
Right.
was like my first. And then I got an honorable mention in the Sassy Magazine fiction writing contest, and I was so excited. And then I also had to talk to the counselor at school because the story was about angel dust. And I'm
Oh.
I'm like the biggest dork in the world. Like, there's no world. I don't even really know what
You're
it
like, it's like pixie dust. Haven't you seen Peter Pan?
Yes.
Right.
And then
Exactly.
short stories were kind of my jam initially, and I love that form. And every time you read a good one, it's like, man, how did they do that? I love the magic trick of a short story. So then in college, I took creative writing, and I also did a lot of journalism in college and high school. And then after college, I forgot I was graduating and did some temp jobs. My parents were absolutely thrilled. Like, I'm back home, like, guys, I'm a theater director because I directed a play. They're like, no, you're not. And then while I was temping, there was an ad in the New York Times for Tiger Beat magazine. And so that was my way into journalism. And then from Tiger Beat to Entertainment Weekly. And at Entertainment Weekly, I was in that young writer zone where I'd be interviewing someone and I'd turn off my tape recorder and be like, here's my short stories and my entourage spec. Like, do you want to give me a job? Like, I look back on things like a different time,
Yeah.
And then I moved out to California to like pursue writing for film and television, wound up on Seventh Heaven and Secret Life. And then eventually I made a short film. And that experience of working with so many people and dealing in the real world with permits and like feeding people and all of it.
Yeah.
And during that process, I lost my father, who I was very close to and had such a like specific voice. And we were very close and like very important in my life. And I feel like there I was sitting there with coming off this short film experience where you have to like communicate to people all the time and missing my dad's voice and knowing like, oh, like that's never coming back to me. Joe was kind of born after that, like from that little fire. And then my dad hated cell phones and was just like, social media is sick. And I'm like, well, if you think it's so sick, that might mean you're sick, right? Like, there's good things
Right.
about it. It was, don't put me on Facebook. Don't this, don't that. Why do you tell people what you're doing? Why don't you do it? And this was all sort of before it's anywhere near like it is today. So
Yeah.
stirring that pot. And it was also with you, it was the first time that I sat down to write a book. And I didn't immediately get self-conscious and try to write what I thought of as a book. I was just like, I'm going to write in this guy's voice. I want to escape. I want to make my mom laugh. I want like a new best friend kind of thing. And
Yeah.
yeah.
What an interesting birth for Joe. But I do love that. I mean, it kind of makes sense because Joe does have, he has his likable qualities for
Yeah,
sure.
and yes, and when you're dealing directly with the world and the system, like things like with making a short, like I was like, we don't need permits if I get some security jackets and have friends stand around, and then the police show up and it's like, no, you actually do need a permit to shoot on a tennis court. When you write a novel, you can go anywhere, and that was my thing. And I feel like part of it was like control. Like Joe is very controlling, and the process of writing a novel is so in that moment when you're birthing something, you're so alone with it, and it's like
Yeah.
singular, and you don't have to ask permission. Like on this page, he's 10. Now he's going to see this person. Now he's here. Now he's there. Like you're not thinking about anything. You're just free, like freely letting your character go where he wants to go.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So do you or did you then sort of pants your way through the novel, or did you have any kind of outline that you worked from? Has that changed at all as you've progressed?
Yeah, that I feel like there's nothing like your first time. And with that one, I was so high. It's almost like falling in love that I was just like in a trance with it. And I'd be in traffic and I'd stop and I'd write. And I had a pretty much full-time job at the time where I was freelancing, but I was always on call. So it was very like, okay, like I just handed in this assignment. I've got right now, I've got this moment, and who knows what's going to happen in 20 minutes. So I wrote it in like when I could. And I think that energy for especially for a first novel was great because mm-hmm. you don't get to be like a princess about it. You don't get to indulge in the like, and I wanted this done. And more than anything, I felt like, yeah, that first novel feeling of like, mm-hmm. I want this out in the world. I want this to be done. So yeah, I knew that I like endings a lot. And I thought about, I always knew how it ends. And that was whenever I got stuck, I'd think of that, like what's going to earn me this ending? What, you know, mm-hmm. figuring out like, how annoying can she be where the reader's like still rooting for them? And mm-hmm. yeah, like, so yeah, a bit of always, I've always been a bit pantsy, a bit plotty. And nice. I like, to me, the outline is the best form of procrastination in the world. Like, I want to say, it doesn't matter if you use it because you worked right. on your book, you learned something when you do it. And mm-hmm. you're not like signing a blood oath that like, now it's done. And it does teach you things, you know, but at yeah. the same time, the other version for me of outlining is like, when I would come up with a character and I liked them, but I couldn't say why or what they were going to do, just sit there and write the dialogue. Like just have Joe like sitting with this person and let them be themselves. And then that inevitably that goes towards something. And that's like my favorite, like that I still do to this day, that I was just doing this morning with something. Yeah. Them talk. Like if you're not, it's kind of like when you're trying too hard.
Yeah.
And if you let them talk and get lost in it and they're just playing, eventually that game has meaning and
yeah.
has stakes. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. I do think sometimes it can feel daunting with an outline, but like you said, I mean, it's not like someone's there being like, oh, you deviated.
Yeah.
Now you must die.
Yes. Do that high too. I like an outline because you have like when you're into it, you're like, I've done it. And then yeah. it's like, no, I didn't. But I feel like in writing, you know, you have to give yourself those highs whenever you can. Like
yeah.
wherever they come from.
Well, and sometimes too, it's always nice to be like, where was I going? What's yeah. supposed to happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Oh, I did this? Yeah.
Yeah. Wait. Okay, right. Here we go. So Do you now have like, I mean, I'm assuming you write full time now. So do you have sort of like a schedule? How do you stick with that kind of, you know, outside of procrastination outlining?
That's a big adjustment to go. Yeah. To go from writing like with that first book to having a job that like was coming at you almost like a stalker, honestly. Yeah. Like, that, you know what I mean? Like, and I wrote synopses of TV shows. But I'd like get one like, did you watch the show last night? I'm like, mm-hmm. And then I'd be like, oh, shit, I have to watch it. And I have to write about it. I have to, you know, and I hate synopses in general. So it was just very challenging. So as over the years, I've changed from to introduce that energy. I'm a morning writer. And I think it's part my brain is just like, I like the early. I like 4:30 in the morning. I like 6 when everything is quiet mm-hmm. and the world isn't like in your face. And I think that's when I do my best, like, my best work. And it gives me that sense of like, okay, like the clock is ticking. Like as it gets later in the day, mm-hmm. my brain goes like that. And I feel like I've heard so many writers have said this. I don't know about you, but like, yeah, it's just, and then you have a deadline. Like I'm a deadline person. So
me too,
I'll be like, okay, at 3:00, you're going to want to go somewhere and do something and, you know, and mm-hmm. so like, you have to do it now. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I definitely find that, deadlines are very, it helps gamify everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's I've always like when people are like, oh, there are those contests worth it. I'm like, contests, schmontests, you're creating a good obstacle, like mm-hmm. in the form of a deadline that like, and it's a given also that when you enter anything, you're going to find 10 typos. You're going to know the way it's really supposed to be, all of it. And I'm like, no one knows when you lost, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, but
yeah, I'm going on Submittable and seeing like 10 of those rejections, but I'm like, people only know about the green ones. Like, yeah,
exactly. Yes. Perfect. Mm-hmm. So what has been your biggest obstacle in writing, either in like the writing itself or just publishing in general, sort of that whole big, you know, endeavor?
Yeah, I think like, the noise of the world that's gotten so much louder over time. And it's not even the social media of it, but like the phone really to me has changed brains in ways that we're not acknowledging, no matter how people get like the hyperbole. I'm like, no, in the simplest way, when I didn't carry this thing around, like when I was 13 years old writing that story, it was like the world was built to make us daydream. So I'll like watch something, see something, watch, you know, binge a TV show. And I feel like we're always having to work a little bit harder to get to the back of our head where that free space just wanders and creates like a kid laying in the grass, you know, like I'll never know if this is true, but I like to think it is. That I knew someone who worked for Steven Spielberg and said that he, like every week he wanted every Happy Meal, and that was his like time that he would just be on the floor in his office, like playing with the toys and eating the fast food and like finding his inner child. So like that kind of a thing, that like I'll get like caught up, distracted, whether it's something fun, some stupid, like whether it's like Punch the Monkey. I'm like, really, is this what we're going to do today? We're going to like look at punch videos for like hours. And then you go to write and you're like punch, 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 punch. Mm-hmm. And getting to that clear space. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I do like the visual of that, because I do think it is important. I mean, especially with writing, like you said, like we don't really pause anymore. Yeah. I mean, even with binging a show, right? Like, you couldn't do that.
Yes, because I think of like the angst of like a Melrose Place cliffhanger, and the way you'd walk around with that, or like waiting every Sunday for Sopranos, like that feeling, like, oh my God.
And dissecting it. And—
And I think so much of learning about yourself and your creativity is getting that feeling of like, oh my God, not only what happens next, but like, I love these people. I can't believe I'm not going to see them for a week, and going through the wait. And now everything just comes, and you have to have discipline. And it's like writing requires enough discipline. So come on, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do agree with like that noise, which, you know, especially when writing someone like Joe, I mean, you know, the books themselves have been quite successful, but then the show has sort of like taken on this whole new identity. Yes. How do you manage your relationship with Joe and your readers while you're writing?
That is wild. And that to me, like I have like this initially off the bat because of Colleen Hoover, bless Colleen Hoover, like talking about my book. It's like she turned all these readers onto it. So I had this immediate like feeling of like, oh my God, like these are my people. They get it. They love him. This is great. And then the show, like, it's like another, it's first of all, it's another version of Joe. You know what I mean? Like, so yeah, that's been something interesting to navigate of like, and it's affected my procrastination. Like my favorite moment was one day I was like trying to write and I'm like, I'm going to, you know, piss off and watch Netflix. I turn it on. It was this great promo where he's like addressing to the camera. And I'm like, no, like, first of all, like now I'm not supposed to, like, this is my time away from you. So yeah, especially when you're writing about stalking and that, where like when you go online and see it. And then you're also so grateful and thrilled that like people love this thing, and it's so much bigger than me. And it's just like a weird, it changes also the way people read the work, because they want to, like, it's natural, they want to make their fan fiction, they want to tell you what how they see them, so there's so much more input. It's like the very opposite of when you're writing something and no one has seen it, no one knows, and you can change, you know, so that's, I think that's probably where the play creative space gets, you got to like work harder to carve that out and separate the two, you know, the three. Because I think that there's book Joe, there's show Joe, and then there's my Joe. You know what I mean? The way like everyone has their relationship to him. And
Because I, you know, you see things, and especially, you know, if viewers who haven't read the book or readers who haven't seen the show, and, you know, there's like a lot of capital O opinions out there.
Oh, yes, there are.
So the you know, now we're talking about going back, and you had your upcoming book with Joe, You First. We are actually going all the way back to before Joe was Joe. Why go back? How did that come about?
It's felt like, you know, when you work on a character this long, and he has so much forward momentum and like leaves things behind so aggressively, that was my, I'm like, well, why? What is the logic behind that? I always feel, I think of myself as a shrink. Mm-hmm. And I got it in my head, because I'm like, the other thing is that when you feel like you know someone because you're writing their thought process, and these books are so like, he's like half the time, I don't know. I'm like, I hope this isn't babbling. I hope that this is like helpful, good, fun reading. But he's like, I know all of his thoughts. And it was like, what is he keeping from me? And then it came out of that, like that we all have something that happened, or that we rewrote, or a lot of us do that. We do that unintentionally when we block things out, or we decide like, this is not going to be the story of my life. Like I'm going to decide And then it came from that of like, well, what would have happened to him that like is so terrible that he can't, that not only it sort of changed his approach to how you handle frustrations in relationships, and that he does not speak of. And it's that thing of the ending kind of coming first with this book, especially, that I was like, oh, I know what he ends up. And now I have to like earn the right to get there. And I have to believe that this is the secret that in all these books, in all this time, that he's never spoken of.
Yeah. It was very fun reading. I mean,
you know. And selfish. Yeah. It was so much fun to write. So I like to hear that. Cause yeah, I guess my editor was like, this is just so entertaining. I'm like, yeah, this is, I'm going through hell right now. And writing this is, it's, I'm having the time of my life. So,
I mean, I already said Joe's my favorite psychopath, but like, he just is a little bit more endearing, you know?
Yeah.
Still a little alarming, lots of red flags, but endearing.
Yeah. And I liked, and imagining too, that like, my thing is like, there are no new story. Like we don't, you know, there are a few stories and we're all just taking our own spin on them in that. So I liked showing like, oh, he thinks it was bad with a computer, that like in that beginning when he's like trying to walk away from it, he's like, well, at least I can't carry it in my pocket. I'm like,
right. Oh.
Like you just wait, baby. Like,
yeah, that was actually really fun. And sort of the little, you know, nods to future books. How tricky was that? Like what to put in, what not to, just kind of that whole process of.
I obsessed over that. Yeah, I obsessed over that because I'm like, I don't want it to feel contrived. And I would go deep into one and then sleep on it and be like, no, come on. And then, yeah, like it's a very delicate balance. So yeah, I worked on that very hard, and I hope, and I'm sure it's a matter of opinion that there's one that's going to be like, oh my God, you know? Yeah. Right. I was like, oh, I can tell when I'm like, oh, I want to mention this. And when it's just coming from the story naturally.
Yeah. And, well, that's always, it's always ideal.
Exactly.
What surprised you the most, both in writing this book and maybe just even in the overall journey of the series?
Yeah, I think that, writing this book, it was like understanding for me that like, oh, because when they talk about childhood trauma, that I'm like, he is by nature who he is. Like, I believe like it's a good nature nurture situation. But the more that I would mention like things about his mother or that, I'm like, you know what? Put this kid anywhere, put him with the like most loving present mother in the world. And he'd be like, no, he'd find issues. So for that, I liked feeling that like, the mindhunter of it, that like, no, something, probably something happened to him, but also that like, this is not situational. This is why so many kids come from terrible circumstances and have, are really well-adjusted and aren't going around killing people. Like, I feel like I found his inner like psycho child that I loved, and this relationship with himself that is toxic, and that he's so good at forgiving himself. And it was fun to see like, oh yeah, like even before he hasn't lived in this world where he's carrying like, you know, like guilt around or fear of paranoia of getting caught. This is who he is at heart. And he was born this way.
One of my favorite things about Joe is like, you know, he is very unreliable in a way. Like even when you're reading this, like you're not quite sure, you know, he obviously believes wholeheartedly in his version of events, but you know, you also kind of get a glimpse of like, but is that the real version of events?
Right. That was the strangest thing about casting, because everyone, when they were like, what does he look like? I'm like, this is going to sound weird. But like when all the time I'm writing this, like I'm in his head and he finds himself handsome and he this and he that. But I'm like, I'm much more auditory with character than visual. And I'm like, I've pictured the way he sees people and the way like, remember something that Jennifer Garner about Ben Affleck, that like when he shines his light on you, there's nothing like it. And when that light goes away, there's nothing like it. And that's kind of how I think of Joe, of like, you don't know if this girl is beautiful. You know that he's like seeing beauty in her. And then to that end, if someone's even the slightest bit mean to him, he's going to be like, well, her hair, this, that, you know, they're ugly. Like, I'm like, so yeah, I was so much more focused on his perception, which is not to me necessarily reality.
Yeah, which is so interesting, especially just the dynamic of writing in that second person. And like, you know, I know that, you know, it can be sometimes very uncomfortable because, you know, you're always like in a character's head, so to speak, when you're reading. But I mean, you are really in Joe's head.
Yes.
And it can be very tricky sometimes to see like what this truth is. I'm just kind of curious, like, as far as like you know, psychology, or, you know, how you, or if you even considered that stuff, or if you just sort of felt Joe out and wrote until it felt true. Does that make
sense?
Yeah,
I got a good boost of confidence in that when I was in high school, where I took this new intelligence test and I did pretty well, I guess. And I got to go to this intelligence experiment at Yale for like a month, and I never went away from home. And it was part, like, at the time, it was just this intense psychology class. And it was the triarchic theory of intelligence, that there's practical, analytical, and creative. And basically, their theory was that if you take someone who's more practically intelligent and put them in a creative room, they're going to fail. If you put an analytical in an analytical setting, they're going to do great. So we had very different, and they wouldn't tell us how we tested. And we worked our asses off, and it was so much work. Case studies of, you know, criminals and abnormal psych, and I loved it. I ate it up. And I'll never forget at the end, and it was something my mom was like obsessed with. I got my report card, and they were like, whatever, some phrase of like disturbingly good at seeing both sides of a situation and a person. And that stayed with me, because I was like, you know, like, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, what are they trying to say? Am I like a sociopath that like I can, because you would read why someone's doing what they're doing. And I think I was very good at explaining why I thought someone did what they did. And that stayed with me. And that was the heart of like all my short stories. Like, I always loved, like, I loved that phrase, you know, that no bad guy thinks of himself as the bad guy.
Right. Yeah.
So I tried to major in psych in college, but I like to write, and you had to take statistics. And so I went through that thing of like every semester I would shop statistics and sit there for 10 minutes. Like, no, like I can't, you guys. Like, I,
yeah.
I remember it was like, I took neuroscience, and I remember like a TA was like, if you don't understand the sodium and the potassium, you can't go forward. I'm like, I don't understand the sodium and the potassium. Like, I don't, I,
yeah.
So I was always interested in that, but in a, like, to that end, like I didn't major in it, but it was always my, like, I like to read articles about that stuff, and something great about the internet. There's so many rabbit holes to go down. And those 4 weeks at Yale did, like, and then we did find out later that there was an element of like seeing what happens when there's this like incredible pressure on teenagers. Like, the workload was like
insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think that is an interesting skill to have, being able to see both sides. So that actually makes a lot of sense in how Joe is the way he is.
And it's like, so even back then I was like, ooh, it's like a backhanded compliment. And obviously in today's world, when you hear both sides, I'm like, it's like considered one of the worst things you can do, which,
yeah,
because we've got a lot of like, what a lot of us, I think is pure evil. That's really doesn't have a side that you can get behind. And yeah.
Yeah.
It's a, yeah.
So, you know, I know personally, I'm wondering, and I'm sure all of your readers are wondering, you know, what comes next? Are we going to see more Joe? There was room for a little bit more, or maybe another special psychopath that we might meet?
I'm stirring up another special psychopath as we speak. Ooh. That I'm at the place where I'm not, like, you know, ready to talk about it, but he is different. Like, she's in a situation that I think would make any of us, like, are the worst version of ourselves. And I'm having fun with that. So to that, I'm like, right, she's a different kind. And it's like it's one of those worst nightmare things that I'm having a great time with, but that's new. And a couple other projects that are also in that, like, not just yet, but, and also, and I just wrote a short story for this Audible series, Twisted, that benefits the International Thriller Writers Organization. And that was great. And that's a serial killer in her 80s. And I love her. And I'm like, I want to go back to her. Like, it's just a short story. And I was like, oh no, I love you. Like, you're amazing. And yeah.
Yeah, that sounds very, all of it sounds very intriguing. Do you think that's the end of Joe's journey then?
Oh no, I never say goodbye with Joe. Even in the show, I was like, don't, like, it's not my decision at all, but I'm like, don't, in my head, I'm like, don't kill him. Don't kill him. Don't kill him. We're like talking about the ending. I'm like, no, do anything you want. Like, yeah, but yeah, like
anything.
Yeah.
But not that.
Yeah. And that's just how I feel about him in general. Like, cause part of me in that thing, I took care of my dad when he was battling cancer. And that phrase, like, it's one of those, I feel like the Joe part of me was like, fuck anyone who talks about the battle when it's not a battle, when it's stage 4 and it was found too late and this person is going through hell and they know they're going to die. So yeah. It's like, if this is not a fair battle, this is ridiculous. Like, a battle has sort of tension in it, where yeah. one person could win and come from behind. And when it's something like cancer, that level, and you can't, it just irritates me. I'm like, Joe is the cancer that is going to survive no matter what. So to me, like, there is a world. I remember once in that middle of the night way, I was like, what if he is a vampire? Because like, just like, I know that cancer part of him, like he'll never die. And there's a great psychology book that I have. I can't think of the name of it, but it's about psychic vampires. And I love reading about psychic vampires, that like the people that you're around them and you're all excited and it's great and they're gone and you're almost dizzy and disoriented.
Yeah.
Basically, it's a theory that those people, like, they steal your energy. They make you think
interesting.
That going back and forth. And yeah, unholy hunger.
Ooh, okay. Yep. I'm going to have to get that. That yes. sounds great.
That's a great, you open any part of it and it's just fascinating.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, I could probably spend all day talking to you.
Fun.
But as we come to the end of our time together, we do like to close the show with the same question, which is, what's one piece of advice you would give to new or aspiring writers?
Let them talk. Let them do the wrong thing. Let your characters, like, I just, for me, I lead with character. Also, let yourself lead with what feels good to you. If you feel like you are someone who is a what if person, who is inspired by what if this happened. And if you feel like you're someone who hears a voice in your head, find out who you are and let it be. And don't fight it, embrace it. Like,
oh, I love that. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jenna.
Talking today. Anyone who's interested in our favorite psychopath, go get you first. I thought it was really a smart idea how she went with a prequel with Joe, because, you know, I don't know if you follow the series, but, you know, it's kind of gone. Like, she took Joe as far as she could, but the popularity was still there. So she went back in time, and it worked really, really, really well. JD, you just kind of did that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, not for those reasons. You know, like, I wrote the trilogy years ago, and it's always done well. But like, I have a 15-year gap in my character's, you know, like, life existence, that I've always thought about. Like, I leave him and he's 15 years old at the end of the last book, and he, you know, basically the beginning, he's 30 years old when these killings start. So I never accounted for those 15 years. So that prompted me to write something, and just the way the books came out. So I thought of Star Wars, you know, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, like, Star Wars came out with 4, 5, and 6, went back and did 1, 2, and 3, and I'm basically doing the same thing. But it's a lot of fun, and it's very refreshing as the author to be able to take a step back and, you know, take those same characters but kind of jump into their heads at a very different time, because they're different people, you know, so you can have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting that she's like, well, I wasn't really sure why he was doing all these things he was doing so we're going to go back and explore that, which is kind of cool.
Well, yeah. She's got a very unique writing style. Like, I'm about halfway through the book now, and I'm loving it. It's really good. But she writes it in first person and sort of like a mix of second person, because the first person is telling the story to the second person. So you. But like, the way that she speaks, like, that, you know, you could feel that energy in the book. Like, every sentence just jumps off the page and pulls you in for more. Like, it is really addictive.
Yeah, she almost like makes you the person getting stalked, which is sort of creepy, but like interesting.
Yeah, and I'm curious, like, I've never read anything else that she's done other than this series. So I'm wondering if, like, this is her writing style. Like, has it always been this, or does she just do this for this particular series? And then she writes, you know, second or third person or whatever, something different when she's doing something else. Because she is
Providence, and that is, it's not written like this. It's written, I don't remember if it's first or third person, but it definitely doesn't have the you part in it, the second person. And I've read some of her short stories, and they don't do that either. So I think she just did it for Joe. It works really well, I think.
That's the other thing. Like, she really gets into this guy's head, and she's not a guy, but like, she does a fantastic job of it. So I'm guessing she's got a lot of little people, you know, consultants and stuff, guys that she's talking to.
Yeah.
I actually kind of liked that Joe, because, you know, Joe is not a good guy, but, you know, Joe is a really interesting character. He's probably one of my favorites just because he is so complex. I did sort of enjoy that her dad kind of sparked a little bit of that with his, you know, sort
cell phone
of
old hatred.
Yeah. Get off your phone type of social media ruin your life. I liked that. I thought that was cute.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting when she was talking about them making the show on Netflix and they're like, what does he look like? And she's like, well, I don't know. Cause I always see out from inside his head, and how she's like, I'm so focused on his perception of reality, or like his perception of how people are versus what might be the reality. But I'm like, that's the way we are. Do you think about how you look? I never do until I'm in the little Zoom box.
Right. Yeah.
I always think about it.
You never really see yourself in your life, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting too.
Yeah.
I have a character in my Kotler books. He's a FBI agent. His name is Roland Denzel. I have never physically described that dude, not one time in any of the books. But every time someone writes to me or talks to me about that character, they talk about how nice it is to have such a competent, powerful black character. I'm like, I've never named his race. His name is Roland Denzel. That's the only clue to who he is.
I've met Roland Denzel, and he is
that's the real world Roland Denzel. And that was a weird coincidence. But he and I are very close friends now. But he has no shot at getting his name out there in literary circles now, because my character is all
ruined
over the place.
It. Good job.
Yeah. My gift to him.
Yeah, that is interesting. Some characters I think I can see pretty clearly, but some of them I think particularly, like, I tend towards the first person. So I think I do tend to see sort of out versus in when I write. So it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah.
There's a show called, I think it's called Smoke, that Dennis Lehane wrote. And I forget what it's on. It might be on HBO or something, but the whole thing is kind of told from the main character's point of view. And he sees himself as this good looking guy. He's a fire inspector. And like, you go through the entire series, and then they flash to POVs from other people. And you actually see that he doesn't actually look the way that we thought he looked. You know, like they visually do this, you know, like he sees himself a certain way, but everybody else sees him for what he really is. And they actually pull it off really well for a TV show to do that, because, you know, you're in the character's head, but now all of a sudden you're not. I think it was called Smoke, but you might want to check that out.
I wonder how you would do that on the page. Like that, that's an interesting concept.
It would be easier on paper, because I think it would be.
Yeah.
Because, well, all right, if the guy looks different, then if he thinks he looks one way, and on screen we can see all that. But if everyone else sees him in a different way, maybe they, I don't know, what is, maybe when you switch POVs, they notice things about him or something, I guess. Well, I don't know.
I think one way that Carolyn Kepnes deals with it, and she talked about it a little bit, and it's kind of stuck in my brain, and I've thought about it. It was like, you know, because Joe is a very unreliable narrator. Like, you know, you can't actually trust his perspective on anything. And so, you know, you hear his rationalizations. And so obviously you're like, I don't know, that kind of makes sense, right? Because you're getting his justification. But then she'll throw clues in about like how other people react. But so you'll read them because he misreads them. And so it's kind of this interesting puzzle that she ends up kind of creating, where you don't necessarily see their straight reaction, but you know, like, there, this isn't a spoiler, but there's this one scene where, you know, he kisses this girl for the first time and she says, "Whoa there, Mr. Tongue." And so he thinks that it was a great first kiss, and then she says that and he goes, "Oh, was it bad? No, it couldn't have been that. She was just surprised. She just loved how aggressive I was." So it's like he reacts and then twists the reality, which I think is an interesting way to do that.
Yeah. So every girl's first kiss experience right there. Hold the tongue. Thank you.
and every guy's.
I think the moral there is we're all the star of our own reality show, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, so we see ourselves, and you know, what we say, everything, we see it in a certain light. Meanwhile, everybody else around you sees it for what it is.
Yeah.
She even said something like that. People don't, no way sees themselves as the bad guy or something like
that.
Right,
yeah. We're all the hero of our own story.
Yeah, we're the hero of our own story. I think, though, it would be interesting, and I think I've seen this occasionally, for you to have a character that is aware that they're the bad guy and isn't over the top about it, and maybe is lamenting it a bit, but, you know, sees it as a necessity or something. That would be kind of fun. I guess... Yeah. We've seen that.
She did that in her villain series. That was a fun series.
Yeah.
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 Cool. With that, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Lauren Oliver coming on. Lauren's a screenwriter, media entrepreneur, and an author of multiple New York Times bestsellers. Her novel, Before I Fall, was adapted into a feature film called Panic and then adopted again as a series on Amazon Prime. She's back with a new thriller called The Girl in the Lake about a girl who claims to remember a past life. And I believe that one just released on June 1st. Lauren Oliver.
Yeah, sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.